It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we mark 100 years of the display of the famous Boaz mastodon at the UW Geology Museum.
First, Wisconsin's gun deer season opened on Saturday, right in the midst of the first big snowstorm to hit the southern half of the state.
Weather aside, some experts expect 2015 to be another low year for the deer harvest. The Department of Natural Resources reports that last year had the lowest number of gun deer license sales since 1976. 2014 saw the smallest harvest in 31 years.
Patrick Durkin joins us now to talk about the predictions for this year's gun deer season in Wisconsin. He's a full-time freelance editor, writer, and outdoors newspaper columnist. He's also the president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. Pat, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you, Veronica.
Well, you were out for opening weekend. How was it?
I had a good hunt. I've been hunting my uncle's property in Richland County since about 1983. He's gone now, and my aunt's gone now, but my cousins still get there every year. So I got down there, and I shot the best buck I ever killed at that farm, so I was really happy.
Well, and there are reports of slow license sales this year. So based on what you've seen, do you expect them to pick up through the rest of gun deer season?
Yeah, it's one of those changes in the law they made a couple of years ago, I think, now, where in the old days, you could not buy your gun license once the season opened, but now you can buy it throughout the season. So you do see more trickling in now as the season goes on. And, the big question is always, if people wait to the opening day, though, to buy a license and then decide, well, it doesn't take much then to make them think, well, I guess not this year. It's very easy to turn it down. Whereas in the past, you had to make your decision before the season, so it probably forced your hand a little bit and made you sign up. So I'm guessing that accounts for some of it. But the bigger trend in hunting participation is, there has been a downward trend. It's been something that the DNR and most wildlife agencies nationwide have been noticing since like the late 80s. They were starting to predict it back then. And now the future is here, and we're seeing that, those predictions were pretty much on the mark.
Well, do you see a diminishing of interest in hunting in Wisconsin?
I can't myself see a diminished interest, except for one thing I've noticed, and it's not my imagination, because I remember going back to 1984, on opening day of our gun season in Richland County. I remember my uncle counting the shots on opening morning, and I think he had like well into the hundreds, number of shots. And these days, on opening day out there, it's really calm, and it's almost like a bull hunt. It's so few people hunting our area. It's still going on, and you see deer being hauled out, but it's not quite the circus we had, 30 years ago.
And what do you think would be contributing to that? Not the circus atmosphere, but things just kind of slowing down. What do you think might be causing that?
Well, the closest thing I've seen and heard about and seen the research on that sounds plausible is this overall, society itself has grown away from the land. We're not that rural based country we were even a generation or two ago. And, hunting has always been kind of a rural, more likely to be a rural background for people who are hunters, or people who are like still tied to other family members and friends who have a rural lifestyle. And we really have been going away from that a lot in the last 25 years or so. So that's probably the biggest contributor. And then, the other thing that's factoring in somewhat is CWD in some areas. It's hit the southwestern Wisconsin area. Initially, that drove a lot of people out. Like, I think it was about 40,000 drop the 1 year. But then it kind of came back for a few years and then started dropping down again. And the research on that from the University of Wisconsin pretty much said that we're past that hiccup now that we had from CWD. And the trend we're on now, we'd probably be pretty close to where we are right now anyway, even without CWD.
Do you think that even among rural areas, that this is something that varies by region in terms of the popularity of hunting?
I don't know for certain. I would assume it does. I remember, I don't know how it is now because I haven't lived in the Madison area for 40 some years now. But I remember opening day of gun season and the Friday before gun season. Trying to get on Highway 14 out of Madison was quite a mess. It was always backed up traffic in all directions, trying to head west on Madison. It might still be that way, but I know up north here where I'm right now, I'm up in Ashland County, and driving up here today from down in the Eau Claire area, I was really, once again, kind of surprised how few people you see out in the woods on the third day of the season. Yesterday, when I was driving across southwestern Wisconsin, I didn't really see many people out, sitting in a tree stand. You see a lot opening day, and then you seem like it just peters out real fast.
We're talking right now with Patrick Durkin, full-time freelance editor and writer, outdoors newspaper columnist, talking about the gun deer season and whether there might be a decrease in interest in gun deer season. And you mentioned chronic wasting disease. So what does that decreased interest in hunting mean for chronic wasting disease and the impact that it might be having? Do you think people care about that when they're going out there to shoot?
Yeah, it's really case by case. Some people have really come to a belief that CWD is not a problem. And I guess it's one of those things when, once you get your attitude set, it's very hard to move people off that position. And right now, what we know of CWD is it's increasing. It's in the areas where it's been found, its prevalence is increasing. It's increasing geographically where it's spreading out from the core area. And, I think in the long term in Wisconsin and in the Great Lakes states, it's going to have a devastating impact at some point. It won't be in my lifetime. I'm almost 60 now, but the way that disease is going and how few, we don't seem to have any real answer for it right now, and we're not spending any money on research into it, really. So I think it's going to kind of run where it's not go. And I think eventually everything we know right now is that that's not going to have a good happy ending for us.
And what does that mean for Wisconsin's deer population, do you think?
I think eventually it'll definitely bring down the herd in the areas where it's highest right now. In the areas up north, and where we don't have lots of great deer habitat right now, we have a lot of mature forest, which doesn't grow that many deer. I think we're going to have an eventual downturn where you can't deny it any longer, where the deer herd is going to be at a younger level, where they don't get into the older age classes anymore. And the overall numbers will start dropping because they just don't have the kind of, you won't have does living to be 7 and 8 years old and producing that many fawns each year, 2, 3 fawns every year.
What do you think could help people renew their interest in hunting, especially younger generations?
There's various things. I often think that the biggest thing they're going for us right now is renewed interest in the venison. There's the younger groups, I'd say, the generation X and the millennials, especially the millennials, are the group that has seen to kind of tap into this idea, the locavore movement, of getting food locally. And I think that has some real promise. Now, how many people want to be the ones who actually go out and kill a deer and butcher it and freeze the meat and then use the meat throughout the year? How many people want to do that? I don't know. But I definitely talk to a lot more young people these days who want to know about my way of doing things, because I've always been a person to butcher my own deer and cut it up, and we use venison for a lot of things in our house.
Now, going back to this year's hunt, one of the reasons some experts were saying that there could be another disappointing deer hunt was that there's not a lot of snow on the ground out there for tracking. Do you see that as something that's affecting it right now?
Well, snow, anytime I can get snow, I love it. And it's not so much because of the tracking, and we always say tracking, but the biggest advantage of snow for deer hunting is it lets you see the deer more easily. Their brown hide blends in so well with the forest background this time of year, and the woodland background this time of year. Even out in fields, when they move across the field, it's harder to see them in some of the tall grasses. But snow really makes them stand out real starkly against the background. And if you happen to shoot one, it doesn't drop on the spot, and it's easy to track them and find them real quickly that way. But it definitely helps you see. Now, I don't know anyone, though, that doesn't go hunting or stays home or whatever because of snow. I look at my track record over the years, and I can't really say that the bottom line is that I get more deer when it snows, but I definitely enjoy it more when there's snow on the ground.
Well, Patrick, thank you so much for joining us today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
That was Patrick Durkin, full-time freelance editor, writer, and outdoors newspaper columnist. He was with us to talk about gun deer season in Wisconsin, which just opened on Saturday. 2015 marks 100 years that the Boaz mastodon skeleton has been on display at the UW-Madison. It stands 10 feet tall and is viewed by about 50,000 people each year. But there's a new twist to the story of one of the most famous fossils in Wisconsin.
The mastodon was originally thought to have been discovered by four farm boys in Boaz, Wisconsin, hence the name. The curator, though, of the UW Geology Museum did some detective work earlier this year to find out that far more of the bones actually came from another community in the Southwest called Anderson Mills.
Carrie Eaton joins us now. She's curator of the Geology Museum at UW-Madison. Carrie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
So first of all, for anyone having trouble picturing, conjuring up a mastodon in their head, what is a mastodon?
The easiest thing to probably picture is a large elephant-like animal. They'd stood about 9 to 10 feet tall, and mastodons have large tusks like an elephant, but they're primitive relatives to the modern-day elephant.
And how common were they in Wisconsin back in the day?
They would have been roaming not only Wisconsin, but much of North America from about 3.75 million years ago until their extinction at the end of the Pleistocene about 11,700 years ago. There have been several mastodon finds in Wisconsin, and you find them mostly scattered across the southern half of the state.
So a very different Wisconsin and upper Midwest back then. What might the landscape have looked like?
Oh, absolutely. It's really neat to think about Wisconsin as having been almost safari-like with a number of large animals that would have roamed this area during the Ice Age. You can picture everything from near-glacial environments with things like tundra and short cold-weather grasses, all the way to a boreal spruce forest, where you would have animals like your mastodon and your giant beaver roaming the landscape.
Wow. Okay, so what were the lives of the mastodons like? I mean, we can't possibly know everything, but they forage in these forests. What did they do?
Absolutely. Mastodons are herd animals, much like modern-day elephants. They were also predominantly browsers, so they would have been roaming the spruce forests of southern Wisconsin, using their teeth to crush up brushy plants, twigs, needles, spruce branches, those sorts of things.
And how did they go extinct?
The most common agreement among scientists is that these large mammals went extinct at the end of the Pleistocene, largely driven by changes in climate. We know that climate was changing through the Ice Age because we can actually mark the margins of the ice sheet retreating northward as that ice melted all throughout the Pleistocene. And then as we transition into the Holocene, about 11,500 years ago, we know that there was a drastic warming of the climate. These cold weather environments and these cold weather plants that these animals really came to rely on largely disappeared. And we had the introduction of large open savannas and prairie grasses and oak trees, which were a completely different type of environment for a completely different type of animals.
So getting to the mastodon in question, there has been this superstar fossil at the Geology Museum, and it's been known as the Boaz mastodon, and it turns out that name might not be so accurate anymore. What have you been finding out about this?
Yeah, it's neat that this discovery came on the heels of celebrating its 100th year on display. We have two mastodons in our museum. One has been known as the Boaz mastodon and has stood on display in our museum for 100 years, and the other was effectively lost for a century, and that's the Anderson Mills mastodon. So about 2 years ago, I started some detective work to look into the history of our mastodon skeleton and its history with the university. And what I discovered was that our skeleton is actually made up of two different individuals, one from Boaz, Wisconsin, and the other from the small hamlet of Anderson Mills, which no longer really exists. It was named for John Anderson's mill, and it was about halfway in between Fenimore and Woodman.
And tell me where Boaz is exactly.
Boaz is near Richland Center in Richland County. And the farm where that mastodon was discovered was very near the town of Dayton.
Okay, so these aren't too far apart, these two sites where these bones were found.
No, not at all. And it's really neat for our museum to have a skeleton that is so closely tied to the histories of rural communities in southwest Wisconsin. I like to think of our skeleton as the very epitome of the Wisconsin idea, reaching out to the communities in Wisconsin and bringing those people to our museum to learn more.
We're talking right now with Carrie Eaton, curator of the Geology Museum at UW-Madison, and we're talking about the Boaz mastodon, which has been on display at the UW for a century as of this year. And you were saying it actually comes from two different specimens. Now, there are two different stories here about how these bones were found. So that the story in Boaz, that discovery, tell us about how that came about.
So after a series of heavy rains, four young boys were out on their family farm inspecting a floodgate, and they saw something large protruding out of the bank of a stream. This was most likely one of the large limb bones of a mastodon skeleton, and as they continued to excavate, they pulled out more bones. Now, what I think is the most charming part of the story is that they wanted to hide their discovery in their farm's milk house, but they actually showed some of the bones to a mailman, who then shared the news with everyone on his mail route, and before long, everyone had found out about the mastodon and was coming to the farm to see the bones.
All right, so the last person you want to tell is the guy who's going to stop at every house around the route. Right, so that got out, so that those were the first pieces of bone, and then you've got these Anderson Mills bones as well. So how were those bones first discovered?
Just a little more than a year later, in the summer of 1898, once again, after heavy rains, a young farmer's son was walking around on his family farm and discovered something long sticking out of the ground. And the first element discovered at that site was actually a 9-foot-long tusk of the mastodon. Assistant state geologist Ernest Buckley rushed out to the scene and actually enlisted the help of local rail workers and farmhands to help in the excavation. And they were able to excavate more than 60 individual bones from that site near Anderson Mills.
So how was it that these two mastodons got their bones sort of jumbled together and had a new mastodon created from them?
It's a good question. We don't really know. The university purchased the bones of each of those finds in 1897 and 1898, and it was petitioned to the Board of Regents in 1900 to mount a mastodon skeleton to put on display. And at that year, the Board of Regents voted that motion down. And so the bones sat in the collection storage of the geology department until 1913, when they hired a new paleontologist, M.G. Mell, who came in and saw these mastodon bones and wanted to put together a mastodon skeleton. So with the help of some of his students, who created some of the plaster replicas that you can see in our skeleton today, they were able to mount that entire skeleton, and it was completed in the fall of 1915. So what happened in between 1900 and 1930, as far as records are concerned, we can't really know whether or not they were knowingly mixing bones of two mastodons or whether those records have been lost. I don't know that we'll ever know the answer to that question.
Well, then, and you came along and kind of went, I wonder, so how did you ever get on the trail of this thing?
I started looking into the mastodon's history, and we, along with David Null at UW Archive, started looking into some of the university correspondence that talked about our mastodon, and we found one letter that mentioned this other mastodon find near Fenimore, and wouldn't it be great if we would go collect these bones so that we could make a complete skeleton? And I thought, wait a second, didn't we just collect a mastodon the very summer before? Didn't we already have enough bones to make a mastodon? We had known about the Anderson Mills mastodon from some historical photographs that a visitor had brought to our museum years before. And so we pulled out those photographs, and I started looking at them with great detail to see if there were things that we could notice in the photographs that were similar to bones in our mastodon skeleton on display. And before long, we started seeing bone after bone after bone that could be recognized in those historical photographs from Anderson Mills.
So is this a big deal, this find?
It's a big deal. Yeah, to be able to basically find a new old mastodon that had been lost for about 117 years is pretty neat. And to be able to welcome a new community into this story is also pretty remarkable as well. In fact, there are actually two bones of the Anderson Mills mastodon that will be on display at the Fenimore Railroad Museum. The day after Anderson Mills was excavated, a local conductor put two of the bones on display at the Fenimore Depot. Those bones were handed down through generations and generations of family, and they were donated to that historical railroad museum in 1993. So after all of this news broke, I got a phone call from the museum, and they said, hey, we have two Anderson Mills bones. Would you like to see them? And I said, absolutely. So they came here for a visit this summer, but they're going to remain on display in Fenimore so people can actually go see the bones of their mastodon.
Is this something, a find like this, these mastodon bones that were discovered in these rural properties, it's still happening today, or was this kind of even unusual for the time?
It does still happen today. In fact, there are two mastodons that were discovered just east of Madison in Jefferson, and those are pretty recent. We do often have to rely on, I call them the tools of discovery, to find these mastodon bones. They're pretty difficult to go out and actively look for. And almost always you see reports of them being found after heavy rains or when a farmer puts in some new drainage tiles or does a little digging on their property. So, you know, we rely on our communities to bring these neat finds to the university and give us the opportunity to share them with people.
And any plans for the fossil's next 100 years? Obviously, you're renaming it. It's not just the Boaz Mastodon, but what happens next?
We're actually working on a new exhibit to tell the narrative of both of these new mastodons. And then next spring, we'll also be completing a new exhibit on Ice Age megafauna, so you can come into our museum and learn about some of those other large beasts that would have roamed our neighborhoods during Wisconsin's Ice Age.
Great. Well, it's quite a story, Carrie. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Carrie Eaton, curator of the Geology Museum at UW-Madison, talking about the Boaz Mastodon and Anderson Mills Mastodon, which has been on display at the UW for a century as of this year.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Earlier this month, the Milwaukee County Board voted unanimously to create a Bureau of African American Affairs aimed at reducing racial inequality and segregation in the area.
Milwaukee is home to the largest community of African Americans in Wisconsin, a state that stands out nationally for big racial disparities in measures of education, health, and the economy.
Wisconsin has the highest rate of black male incarceration, the widest academic achievement gap, and the highest black unemployment rate in the country.
There are now moves to create similar African-American affairs committees on the city and state levels. Here with us now to talk about the bureau set up by the Milwaukee County Board is Supervisor Khalif Rainey, the author of this legislation. Khalif, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, take us back to the beginning. What gave you the idea to set up this Office of African-American Affairs?
Well, you know, in college, I worked in the Student Life, Student Affairs Department while I attended Southern University Historical Black College in Baton Rouge. And, you know, it was a moment when I thought to myself, wow, how helpful an office on African-American affairs would be to the African-American people here in Milwaukee County, where, as your intro shared, you know, we have the shameful designation of being the absolute worst place in America to be in related to many metrics. So I looked into it, and lo and behold, you know, there were offices of African-American affairs in the state of New Mexico, in the mayor's office in Washington, D.C., and there were several commissions around the country. So what I did was I looked at what they did, and I kind of customized the legislation to be applicable to what the needs are here in the African-American community of Milwaukee County, which are, you know, small business creation, you know, incarceration, education. You know, many of us are aware of these shameful statistics, but, you know, for us, the African-American people, this is life. You know, this is a reality that we wake up to every day. We actually reside in the absolute worst place for African-American people to live. And I think this is an opportunity for us to really reverse some of those statistics. And I'm excited about the office and the prospects of it.
Now, this has passed the county board there unanimously, as I understand. The county executive there, Chris Abley, is in favor of this. So once it's up and running, what does this look like? Who is on this office? Who's working this office? What does it do?
Right now, I have acquired a position for a grant writer within the office. I think it's extremely important that here in Milwaukee County, we have a concerted, deliberate effort to go and pursue grants and endowment money. You know, during my conversation with the research analyst here in Milwaukee County, Ms. Erica Hayden, you know, we discovered that there wasn't a streamlined grant writing process here in Milwaukee County. So there was opportunities that Milwaukee County may have been eligible for in regards to these statistics that we weren't pursuing. So a grant writer, we have to have a leader in that office. And through the budget process, I have obtained $300,000 through a budget amendment for seed money for operating costs. You know, but I've asked the county executive to match that contribution in some form, provide a resolution when he returns his plan to at least allow the office to start with enough money where we can actually attract the talented leader for that office who could come to the table and speak on behalf of African-American people, you know, speak on policy. You know, one of the major pieces about the office is speaking to regard policy. You know, imagine if we had an office on African-American affairs at the state level where we could have spoke to some some of this legislation that's had a damaging impact on the lives of African Americans. You know, those are two of the purposes of the office. You know, here in Milwaukee County, we have jurisdiction over many of our cultural amenities, our cultural assets. The preservation of the culture and the heritage of African Americans is extremely important as well. So this can be a conduit. This could be a hub. This could be a concerted, concentrated, deliberate effort to actually reverse these statistics. And, you know, I'm hopeful it could become a model for other communities of colors around the country.
Now, there are a number of nonprofits and volunteer groups in Milwaukee County and elsewhere, for that matter. Do you see this as kind of a partnership with them in the future?
You know, one of the things I didn't foresee, you know, when I was developing the policy was the response from the greater Milwaukee community. You know, I kind of just had African-American people in mind. I think that many African-American elected officials, you know, in their pursuit of service, during their service, you know, whether it was the Reconstruction era, whether it was Jim Crow era, you know, we're fighting here, carrying on that mantra, you know, fighting for equality, fighting for justice. You know, so I think that all of us have in mind that we want to do something impactful, you know what I'm saying, for African-American people. So, you know, there's been a groundswell of support. You know, I've seen members from the business community come to the table and express interest. That's something I didn't foresee. You know, individuals who are developers, they're interested in pushing this office to integrate, you know, some of those neighborhoods in Milwaukee County, be it New Berlin, be it Oak Creek, be it Franklin. Maybe this is an opportunity that we can address those segregation issues here in Milwaukee County. So there's one thing I recognize is that this office will take the shape of many things that I did not foresee, you know, in the future. And I'm excited to see the response from the community and have everybody joining together to make this thing valuable to our community.
Talking to Khalif Rainey, he's a supervisor on the Milwaukee County Board. He was behind legislation. He wrote legislation creating an Office of African American Affairs there in Milwaukee County. So there's a big list of problems this new office could tackle. Khalif, what are some of the biggest challenges? What do you think is at the top of the agenda when it comes to problems that need solving?
You know, for me, I really truly believe that, you know, employment is one of our major issues. You know, we here in Milwaukee, at one point in time, we actually was the best place in America for African Americans to live. You know, we had a manufacturing industry where, you know, you can go following high school and make $50,000, $60,000 a year. You know, right now we don't have that. There's been a decimation of the manufacturing industry and a lot of people are out of work. I think this could be an opportunity for us to examine things, build partnerships, find opportunity to bridge gaps and put people back to work. To me, that's a priority. You know, secondly, leading the country in incarceration. Like, you know, a good friend of mine, Wayne Ford, a state representative in the state of Iowa at one point in time, he introduced a piece of policy called a minority impact statement. Because at that time, Iowa led the country in incarceration, and it was something that all the people of Iowa agreed. It was shameful, regardless if you were black or not. On a humanitarian level, it was shameful for the state of Iowa to have that distinction. So I'm hoping that the people of Wisconsin agree and feel the same way. You know, this is not something that we want to be known for.
So what kind of things, you mentioned a positive response from the business community, some other place you didn't expect. How about your fellow supervisors there? Were they approved this unanimously? What kind of things did you hear from them?
You know, I think that many legislators in the state of Wisconsin, you know, be it here, my colleagues on the Milwaukee County Board or the state reps or the common council members, I think many people have been thinking hard on how we can address these issues. You know, and I do think there's efforts within government, but they're fragmented. Here in Milwaukee County, we have an opportunity to put it all together under one roof and be very deliberate with what we do. You know, I think there's an excitement. I think that there is a interest in the policy here in Wisconsin simply because no one has really figured out how to begin to tackle the issue. And I think that here in Milwaukee County, we put together some policy and we've unanimously supported. And I think although here in Milwaukee County, we're considered, you know, almost a lame duck body of government, I think with this policy, we've really demonstrated our strength despite Act 14 and demonstrated to the entire state that as a county supervisor, you could really make productive policy and show leadership to an entire state.
Sometimes when a government agency sets up an office, the public might be skeptical, thinking, oh, great, you've created a little bit of bureaucracy. Is this really going to affect my life? How do you respond to that kind of skepticism that might emerge?
Well, you know, I actually experienced that skepticism from African-American people themselves. You know, when you discuss, you know, a government and African-Americans, you know, it was slavery itself that was a policy, and it took an act of policy to reverse that. So, you know, I had a conversation with one of my advisors at one point in time, and he shared with me, you know, that, you know, doing my service, you know, I'm going to have to prove myself because in many scenarios, all those before you were liars and thieves. So there's a skepticism amongst African-Americans as well when it comes to the Office on African-American Affairs. What I could tell you is this, is that us sitting back doing nothing is definitely not the solution. You know, whether it be health, African-Americans, adults are the absolute most obese in the country. You know, the litany of issues that have given us the distinction is beyond, you know, just job creation. You know, there's many ways in which this office can make an impact. And if you could demonstrate that a group here in Wisconsin is at more risk than African Americans are, then I certainly would be all on board with you as well to create an office for their needs.
We're talking to Milwaukee County Supervisor Khalif Rainey about the approval of an Office of African American Affairs in Milwaukee County. He authored the legislation that passed unanimously earlier this month.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you support the creation of an Office of African American Affairs on a state or a local level? And what kinds of issues do you think an office like that should take on? You can call at 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with Milwaukee County Supervisor Khalif Rainey about the approval of an Office of African American Affairs in Milwaukee County. He authored the legislation that passed unanimously earlier this month.
You could join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are there groups in your community tackling racial inequalities or segregation? What questions do you have for Khalif Rainey about how this office might work? What should be the top priority at the city, county, or state level when it comes to issues of racial inequality? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Khalif, you mentioned briefly earlier that this is in the county, at the Milwaukee County level. There's talk of similar efforts at the city and state level. Can you tell us about those?
Sure. You know, when I developed the policy, I thought it was important that we have it at every level of government where, you know, the concentration of African Americans happen to be here in Wisconsin, that being Milwaukee County and that being the city of Milwaukee. And with that being said, I recruited Alderman Willie Wade, who will be introducing similar legislation to create an office at the city level. I've also recruited State Representative Leon Young and State Senator Lena Taylor to introduce the legislation at the state. You know, there's been some questions, you know, as to how these offices will work in concert and if there's actually a need for three offices, such as an Office on African American Affairs at those levels of government. You know, I think it's important at the state level that, you know, we provide protection for the African American people of, say, Madison or Beloit or, you know, Racine. You know, here in Milwaukee County, we'll have it in the city of Milwaukee. Hopefully they'll create it. But at the state level where, you know, some of the policy that has really had a negative impact on African Americans, I think it's very critical that you have an Office of African American Affairs there, you know, to have a role in the shaping the policy and programming and et cetera. So, you know, Alderman Willie Wade will be introducing that legislation soon. Representative Young will be bringing forth his version of the legislation, and, you know, I will be present at both of those occasions and making sure that, you know, I let them know the importance of this legislation and exactly what I had in mind when I authored it.
When it comes to issues of race, there can be a big partisan divide over how to handle these issues, the extent of problems on the one hand, what the right solutions are on the other hand. To get something like this at the state level, you need cooperation across party lines. Do you think that there's common ground, things that people from both sides of the political fence can agree on, work together, actually get something done?
You know, I truly believe that here in Wisconsin, this is the issue of our time. You know, I don't see any issue more important to the city of Milwaukee, Milwaukee County, the state of Wisconsin, than the issue of the quality of life for African Americans here in our community. You know, much of the state goes the way of Milwaukee. You know, Milwaukee, we are the economic engine of the state, And, you know, the entire state, you know, depends upon our productivity and efficiency. So, and beyond that, you know, we're just speaking on a human level, you know, like many of us are aware of the statistics, and it's a shame, you know, but for us, it's a reality. This is something that we wake up to every day and we live, you know. Those statistics, I know the faces of those people, you know, that's my brother, that's my sister, you know, that's my neighbor, you know, these dreams deferred and these realities shattered, you know, we have to do something about that. And I think that there is a common ground, there's an opportunity for people to come together and see eye to eye in the creation of such an office. So I'm hopeful that at the state level, we can, despite the politics, we can get it done.
Talking to Khalif Rainey, he's on the Milwaukee County Board, talking about legislation he authored creating a new Office of African American Affairs. To your calls now at 800-642-1234. If you're from the Milwaukee area, what do you think of this idea? What should be job one for this Office of African American Affairs in Milwaukee County? I will go now to Walter with us in Madison. Walter, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Khalif, I just wanted to make a comment. I think that it's outstanding, the plan that you've put together. I think it's much needed for the folks in the African-American community to have a voice and a point of focus. I don't know why someone hasn't thought of this earlier, and absolutely it should get put together on the state level as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I truly appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Walter, thanks for that call. And Walter, calling from Madison. Khalif, have you heard of other cities or counties in the state maybe following your lead here?
You know, I'm aware of some efforts to create offices of equality, offices of justice, you know, for just for, you know, humanity issues. But I thought it was important considering the dire need, you know, for the African-American people of Wisconsin, that we had something specific, you know, to address the concerns. And it's my hope that at some point in time, you know, we can dissolve this office. It's no longer needed. You know, we've actually reversed these statistics, and, you know, we no longer need this office. So, you know, at this moment, you know, I think it's imperative that we begin to tackle these issues very deliberately, and that's what this office calls for.
We had a call from Evan in Milwaukee, and he was wondering if the schools are going to be a part of this effort, how young people and their education might be a part of this Office of African American Affairs.
Absolutely. You know, education is certainly a priority of this office. It's one of the metrics that we have established as one of the major concerns. You know, the statistics as it relates to education, as far as suspension and the disparity between the African-American student and the white student, you know, it's shameful. The onus of the actual development of the Office of African-American Affairs, and I think this is important that the public be aware of that, is on the administration. You know, I'm a policymaker. I make policy. I say, hey, this is a good idea. I think this is a policy we should adopt as Milwaukee County. Now, the administration is the Abley administration. Now, Abley has to implement the process, the policy, you know, engage stakeholders, figure out how to make it workable with what Milwaukee County already is and make it an asset to our community. Now, I can make wonderful policy, but if the follow-through isn't there by the administration, if the resources, the funding isn't there, you know, then it's just going to be all for naught. So I hope that the county executive engages the public. I think it's important that the public has an opportunity to have a say-so and be aware of exactly how this office will work and how they can use it as a resource in their community. So I'm looking forward to hearing what his plans are. He intends on providing the county board with a blueprint as to how he plans on implementing this policy within 45 days. So I'm looking forward to hearing that.
Well, these problems aren't going to be solved overnight, obviously, but let's take you ahead 2 years from now. Say, at that point, what would make you say, okay, this has been done right, we are on the right track with this office?
You know, again, as I've shared in the past, you know, I don't think this is a magic bullet. You know, I think when you consider the history of African Americans in this country, you know, we didn't get into the situation overnight. But I hope that within a couple of years, we can look at the work that we're doing. You know, we can examine it and see where our shortcomings are and where we have really demonstrated, you know, a benefit to the community. You know, one of the things I'm most excited about with the office is a grant writer who has the sole mission of pursuing grants, endowment money on behalf of the mission of the office. That's something that we don't have here. at Milwaukee County. You know, a lot of things were being overlooked. You know, not having someone at the table having a role in government advocating on behalf of the African Americans as it relates to the Milwaukee County toolbox, whether it be our bus system, whether it be transportation, we need to have more routes going to these jobs, whether it's within our park system. You know, we have some shortcomings with hiring. We could do these things to present youth with job opportunities, whether it's at our cultural amenities. We need to have better African-American art exhibits at the art museum. I think this office could be an asset and a value in many different ways.
And briefly, as we wrap up, are you hoping that the public gets involved, community members?
Definitely. You know, and I've received many phone calls, emails, you know, from community members who have an interest in the office. You know, I think there's opportunity for us to engage organizations such as the Wisconsin African American Law Association. You know, maybe work with them to address some of the legal issues here in Milwaukee County. So I think that, you know, it needs to be a public process where we all come together and figure out how we all can work together to make this office a real asset to our community.
Khalif, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
We've been talking to Milwaukee County Supervisor Khalif Rainey about the approval of a new Office of African American Affairs in Milwaukee County. He wrote the legislation that passed unanimously earlier this month.
Humans ever seen this? You'll be the first.
All I want to see is my bed.
Donna Noble, welcome to the creation of the earth.
Who could take a human back in time and space to see the creation of the earth? Only the Doctor, from the long-running science fiction TV show Doctor Who.
And today marks the creation of the British TV show. It premiered on this day in 1963, and the episode, the very first one, was called An Unearthly Child.
William Hartnell was the very first in what's now a very long line of doctors, including Tom Baker, the one with the crazy scarf, and the one of my childhood. Newer guys David Tennant, who we just heard there, Christopher Eccleston, Peter Capaldi, and more. They're all reincarnations of the same guy who travels the universe in a British police box. It's like James Bond is a whole bunch of different guys, but they actually have a science fiction reason that they can have different actors
right.
Over 50 years.
Slight reincarnation. Well, the Doctor Who universe has given us so much. It's given us the Daleks, mm-hmm. who will exterminate, and K-9. Do you remember K-9?
Oh, yeah,
from the Tom
robot
Baker
dog.
Days?
Yeah,
right, the
yeah.
robot dog. Brilliant special effects from the early years.
They made
foil,
so
basically.
Much good stuff with cardboard. Yeah. And I remember watching as a kid, and this was back in the days of antennas, and we could get Detroit stations and Windsor stations. There's a place called Sarnia. If you turn the antenna just right, you could get an extra episode of Doctor Who over the course of a week.
And, of course, who could argue with this music?
Right. Doctor Who here at Central Time on the Ideas Network.